The debt ceiling, debit card safety, and the holy grail of conservative investing. Just a few of the topics on this week's edition of On Your Money. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is coming up on 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, May the 17th. And financial planner Kevin McKinley is here. He is in the house with smart money advice and answers to your personal finance questions. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question for Kevin. Or you can email us on yourmoney@wpr.org. Well, let me welcome Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, who has offices in Eau Claire and Madison, and it just so happens he is in Madison today, so we don't see each other very often. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
It is nice to have you here in studio, and you are in town because of office hours?
Yep, doing a little work and a little pleasure. My lovely wife, Rachel, and I came down last night and had a chance to tour through the campus again. You know, I have an idea here of something. This may be a a little unconventional, but something to, help improve the UW-Madison campus.
Do tell.
They should try, like, some construction.
You don't have enough of that around here.
Or renovation or something. Maybe, dig a hole or put a new facade on or something.
Did you see any cranes while you were walking around?
I saw one or two cranes. Yes, I did.
I saw some cranes at the International Crane Foundation this weekend, but a different kind.
Yeah. I bet that's a fun group of people.
Yeah, it is. It's a busy place around here. But, well, hopefully, Kevin, spring has sprung and we can enjoy spring in Wisconsin as we go along here. Let's talk about the debt ceiling. I heard all these stories yesterday that the U.S. reached the debt ceiling yesterday. Exactly what does that mean?
Well, it's a real hot topic. The question is how likely or dangerous it is if we actually break through it. It makes a real convenient bone over which to fight. The current limit, and this is really how much by statutory amount that the United States can borrow, and it's $14.3 trillion. And we've actually just kind of gone up to it, but Treasury Secretary Geithner is doing some tricks. Apparently, he dug behind the sofa cushions in D.C. and found some more money to get us through to the end of July. The real issue here is that we are spending much more money than we're bringing in taxes. We are bringing in about $2.6 trillion for 2012, and the federal government's expected to spend about $3.7 trillion. Plus, there are a lot of other programs that aren't really figured into the budget, and there's not a lot of other revenue that's outside of the budget as well. The nice thing about this situation, and some people say it could be part of the cause of the problem, is that interest costs are very low. So it means that at least the debt is rising and is very high, but the cost of maintaining that debt is very low.
Well, so by the end of July or early August, the debt ceiling, there needs to be a vote from Congress to raise the debt ceiling?
That's right. And what happens is they just go through this as a procedure, but we're the only country really that has this, the major country that has this in place. Most other countries say, oh, we need to borrow more money. Can we borrow more money? Okay, let's borrow more money. And it's a good idea. In many cases, again, it also becomes a lot of political fodder for raising it and for capping it.
Yeah, so what are the arguments for or against raising the ceiling?
Not surprisingly, they come down to mostly political arguments. The Democrats say that the economy needs it, and maybe more importantly, people need it. There are a lot of people out there struggling right now, and if they didn't have the government support, they'd be struggling even more so. And cutting federal spending or capping the debt ceiling could make the situation even worse, both for those people and for the economy. The Republicans bring up a very good point, says we can't just keep doing this and doing this and doing this. We need more discipline in terms of where we're spending, and they would just as soon have us cut spending instead of raising taxes. And they point out, this is an excellent point, that the problem going forward could be and likely will be much worse because Social Security and Medicare and the interest make such a huge portion of the debt, and at least two and maybe three of those things are likely to be more expensive in the future rather than less.
So what do you predict will happen?
There will be a lot of pundits punditing about it and discussing it and saying that this is it, this is the end, but probably not much for now. In the last 10 years, there have been 10 increases in the debt ceiling. We've seen this before. 20 years ago, the debt ceiling, which again is $14.3 trillion, it was $4 trillion. And even just a few years ago, it was $8 trillion. As a percent of gross domestic product, which is usually a better measure of the debt ceiling, it's still extremely high, but it's not an absolute record depending on which numbers you use. What's really interesting is the public's reaction for this. The public says, we don't want you to break the ceiling. We don't want you to spend any money you don't have to, but don't cut anything as well, and don't raise our taxes. Politicians are arguing over very small amounts of raising taxes and cutting because the three of the biggest expenditures are Medicare and Social Security and defense. And very few politicians are willing to go on the record publicly saying that I really want to cut any of these issues for it. So what I think is going to happen is they're going to bicker about it for a while and then eventually they'll raise the ceiling.
Yeah, well, but there have been some lines drawn in the sand where, like the House Speaker, Republican John Boehner, said no tax increases, so that there's not a lot of negotiation then, is there?
Well, that's right. The key word there you used was sand, which is a malleable property. So I think that there will be more lines drawn in the sand or whatever. There's always an issue that, you know, the United States might technically be in default if they can't bring up enough money to print that off.
What does that mean if the U.S. goes into default?
Well, it just means that they cannot really raise enough cash to meet their interest payments, and especially one of the dangers that the Treasury securities have for the United States is a lot of them are very short-term maturity. So if interest rates rise, they have to if the interest rates rise, they'll have to reissue the bonds at a higher interest rate, which will be much more expensive for the country for it. So hopefully they'll go out longer and do that. But if they can't make an interest payment, it would probably be something that the actual act would not be the biggest issue. It would be the time frame leading up to it that would cause people to really freak out. It would mean higher interest rates, people more frightened about borrowing costs, people moving money out of treasuries. But right now, there's a real high demand for United States debt, mostly from the Fed, but also the Chinese and foreign governments, and also United States investors are still really interested in United States debt. That keeps interest rates low. If interest rates rise, that's going to make some trouble. It's kind of like instead of making your mortgage payment, which most people can do, you're making a credit card payment, which instead of 5% interest, it's 18% interest. And because the United States basically has about 23% of all the debt issued in the world by governments is belongs to the United States. It's a huge market, so it has to sop up a lot of money. I'm not sure where all that money is going to go throughout the rest of the world. I think that if it comes to an actual technical default, it'll be something that's a blip, and then actions will be taken to smooth it over just like they have in the past.
Here's my prediction, Kevin, and we can check back the end of July, early August. On the Friday or Saturday before the day of the deadline at about 11 o'clock at night, what do you think? That's when we're going to find out.
That's when they're going to find out. That's when the dump is going to be released. Well, you'll be here at your post waiting to report on it.
Right. So we will. We'll check back and we'll see who's right coming up later in July or early August. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin about personal finances, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. We'll get to your calls in just a moment. You can also email us onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And it's time now for the On Your Money email bag. And Kevin, we're getting lots of questions about annuities paying some extraordinary rates to new depositors. Are these as good as they seem?
Excuse me for a second. Now that I'm in studio, I never knew we actually had a live band performing that music.
It's
this
pretty
is
nice,
really,
isn't it?
Yeah, thanks, folks. You guys are great.
Would you like a cocktail?
Yeah. Yeah, speaking of cocktail, well, this is a question that I've been getting out in public. About these types of investments. Investors are obviously looking for a higher yield than what so-called safe investments like CDs and money markets can provide. And insurance companies are responding, and some of them are promoting fixed annuities that seem to have rates of 6 to 7% or more. And because it's insurance, which most people associate that word with safety, and there's a tax deferral component to it, at least until the money is withdrawn, it seems like a really good deal, especially when you have a nice person, enthusiastic in a nice suit, telling you what a great deal it is with pretty brochures of, you know, gray-haired people walking on the beach. And that's something that they use to promote this. So it seems like a good deal. It's not nearly as good as it can appear.
I want that job when I retire, by the way.
You could do that. You're still too young looking.
So what's wrong with these annuities?
Well, the yield from these investments isn't from investing. It's actually a bonus usually paid by the insurance company issuing the annuity. And, of course, after a brief period, the yield is going to quickly drop down to something much lower and much more conventional if this bonus were in place, which is usually going to be about 2 to 3% depending on the time frame and the type of investment.
So if I have one of these, can I take the money out then?
Absolutely. You can usually take it out whenever you want. The problem is the insurance company will clobber you with fees known as surrender charges that can be 10 to 15% of what you pull out and can last for several years and even more than a decade. So if you said, well, I put $100,000 in, I got this great 7% interest for a year. Oh, the interest rate dropped down to 2 or 3%. I'm going to pull it out. It could cost you 10 to 15% or $10,000 to $15,000 in surrender charges if you pull that money out.
That's a bite. So should we stay away from these?
Not necessarily. I would just be very skeptical and cynical of it. Make sure that you understand everything about it. First of all, the cost, not only the surrender fees. Look, don't just take the person's word for it. Look in the contract and ask to see the surrender charge schedule. And then also know what the annual expenses are of the underlying annuity. These things can be very expensive because they have to pay the insurance company and they have to pay the person selling it. And then they have to try to earn the money on the investments as well. Another good question to ask about annuities is not only how the advisor gets paid to sell this to you, but what are they getting paid? And if that person says nothing, that person is either delusional or is doing this on a volunteer basis or something. They're actually getting paid, and you should probably walk away if they say that they're doing it for free. Also know that if you do put money into an annuity, the nice thing about most annuities is the taxes on the earnings are deferred until you actually pull the money out. But when you pull the money out, you'll pay taxes on that at your highest income rate. If you like what you see, even after all that, still just put a portion of your money in for that. And keep listening to the show because we have a better alternative to these later on.
Good. So stay with us. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. If you have a question, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone.
Well, Kevin McKinley to the rescue. If you have a question about personal finances, he can help. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he is here with us just about every Tuesday for On Your Money. And Kevin, our first caller is Andrea in Green Bay. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. First of all, I want to thank you for your continued discussion regarding reverse mortgages. My mom actually went to a seminar a couple weeks ago, and we met with one of the, I don't know if you want to call them sales reps or whatever, regarding it, and I actually sort of knew what I was talking about with this gentleman.
Good for you.
It really looks like, you know, it's going to be a beneficial thing for her, and she's going to get that lump sum of money, but she only needs you know, a certain amount of it to do the things around the house that she wants to do and a few other things. My question is, can she take, like, whatever's left and gift it to family so that it's secure somewhere? Like, 'cause she's concerned that if she ends up in a long-term assisted living facility, mm-hmm. they'll suck her dry.
Mm-hmm. You mean her finances, of course.
Yes.
Right.
Right, yeah. So we're just thinking, is there a way to at least take some of that money and put it in a secure place that no one can get to? Legally, of course.
Of course.
Of course.
I don't even know why you'd have to add that, Andrea. Yes, it can be done. The question is, should it be done? First of all, reverse mortgages, I'm really glad you are willing to pursue this with it, because for some people, it really is the only option to do what they want to do. And to stereotype it, it's usually a woman, a single woman, widowed in her early 80s, and she's trying to keep her home. She's in great shape, except she just doesn't have a ton of cash to support her her rising living expenses. And reverse mortgages are a viable option for it. They're not perfect, but they're a better solution than trying to sell the house and move to an apartment and reinvest the money.
Right.
So good for you. Now, in terms of giving it away, first of all, if she were to go to some kind of facility, there's usually a 60-month look-back period for that. So she would have to stay out of the facility for 5 years before the gift would be out of her situation.
Okay. Well, and she's only 67, and she's very healthy.
Okay. If she gives the money away when you say where no one else can touch it, it means she can't touch it either, other than by the good graces of to who she gives it. I would much rather have her just keep the money and keep it set aside safely, because it can create a problem, because it's not a perfect solution to say, well, we'll just qualify for public assistance, because public assistance is just what you might expect of it. And it's a very basic level. And I'd rather have her have the money to try to pay for whatever care she needs, rather than trying to hope that if and when she does need that care, there's some type of public program for it, because it's a problem now, as many people know who have gone through this for themselves or for a parent. It's going to be worse in the future. And if the money's gone, it's gone, and it's difficult to coerce someone sometimes to get it back. It can be done. I'm apprehensive about saying it should be done.
Okay. My other question then would be, what would be a good thing for her to do with that balance of money?
Certificates of deposit, straight CDs, okay. Get a long maturity with a very low penalty for early withdrawal, preferably at a local institution like a bank or a credit union.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Thank you, Andrea, very much for the call. Liz in Stevens Point is with us now. Hello, Liz.
Hi. My question is, historically, people heading into retirement have been advised to put more of their money into bonds. But I more recently read an article where it was recommended that because of the longevity people are starting to experience, that they may want to maintain their investments in more of a risk-oriented sector and wait for the bond investment portion to increase later in life. Do you have any input on that?
Yes, I'm glad you're trying to research this, Liz. I can about guarantee you that there is one other article that's written the exact same opposite, and there will be another one for the other way coming back down the road. The question is not so much, are you getting a high enough yield? That's a fear many people have about retirement, is that if they go safe and become turtles in their investing strategy, that their money will be there, but it won't grow fast enough, especially when you're filling up your tank and it's costing $60 a tank or whatever to fill it up. And you see gas at $4 a gallon and milk at $4 a gallon. It's easy to see why, oh my gosh, this money's going to run out. That could happen, but it's a more slow, insidious erosion of your purchasing power rather than the swift and rapid and painful declines that more risk-oriented investments can bring to you in hopes of getting this long-term growth. And we've talked about this on the show in the past, but, you know, getting a the example we did, Joy, was over 5 years. If you got 10% the first year, 10% the second year, lost 20% the third year, made 10% the fourth year, and made 10% the fifth year, I think we figured out that you made 3% average over the 5 years' time. And that's assuming you were able to ride it out and then get those times. And especially one of the reasons I'm really concerned about people staying aggressive when they are retiring is you are taking what is probably the biggest financial challenge in your life, because when you're, you know, you're 22 or whatever, you don't have any money, you don't have anything to lose. Now you've got everything to lose, and you're trying to do it at a time when, we talk about this every week, this is the most volatile financial time in our lifetimes. And if you are making this huge life change while you are also invested very aggressively, I hope I'm wrong, and I hope that the Dow keeps charging up to 36,000 or whatever. But if something happens that really causes you a big 20 or 30% drop, that'll seem way more painful and way more frightening at this time in your life than, you know, making 3% versus 4 or 5 or 6 or 8%. So I'd still prefer a safer fixed income portfolio, especially on May 17th of 2011 for people who are just going into retirement.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Liz, for the call. An email from Katie in Washburn. I'm a recent college graduate. Congratulations, Katie. I have a question about credit cards. I just returned from working 8 months in France and notified that the very few people in France have credit cards. I noticed that very few people in France have credit cards. I was wondering if it is really necessary in this day and age to have a credit card. I realize credit is needed for large expenditures, but do you think it's possible to live without a credit card or put off getting one?
Well, first of all, I like the notion of the words working and in France in the same sentence. I know for a fact when people, especially people from Wisconsin, go to either coast, that because they're from Wisconsin, they're viewed as these industrious farm kids. Even they could be the laziest kid in their high school class, but if they go to Los Angeles, they're the industrious, hardworking farm kid. I can imagine what that was like when she actually went to France. So good for you, Katie. Good congratulations on graduation. You can live without a credit card. The question is, should you? And I think you should not, because I think there will be things in your life that you cannot imagine that will come out of the blue that will require more cash than what you have on hand. Or if you have to spend all of your cash at that time, then the next emergency or unexpected expense that comes along is still going to require a credit card. So what I'd prefer, Katie, is that you get a credit card and then don't use it unless it's in an emergency. Take a get your credit card and put it in a jar of water and put the jar in the freezer and put the lid on, and then it'll take you an hour of thawing before you can use it if you're tempted to use it. So if you're tempted to spend that money that you really don't have on frivolous things, don't get the credit card. Otherwise, get it, but don't use it for anything other than an emergency.
Good luck, Katie. One more call from Rana in Rice Lake. Rana, I love your name.
Oh, thanks. And thanks for not calling me Rhonda. That happens more often than getting called Rhonda. Good morning, Kevin. Good morning, Joy. Just a question on gifting. My parents would like to gift me with some money this year. And what are the limits with that? How much can they gift? Do they have to gift jointly? Can they gift individually? We're just trying to figure it all out.
Sure. The limit from a tax basis that one person can give another in a calendar year is $13,000. So in theory, your parents could each give you $13,000 without incurring any gift taxes. They can give you more than that, but they can, if they do that, they have to file a gift tax return. And if they do that, then they have to use up a lifetime exemption. They have $1 million they can give away also on top of the $13,000. The reason these laws are in place, by the way, is not that, you know, they don't want your parents to spoil you. Of course they want that. But they don't want people to avoid estate taxes by just transferring the money all to the children on their deathbed and then not incurring the estate tax. So they can give $13,000 per person per calendar year. And then if they give any more than that in the calendar year, they have to file a gift tax return.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you very much, Rana, for the call. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and you can join in with your question about personal finances at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin, you say that we may have uncovered the holy grail for conservative investors. What is the holy grail?
Well, it's a sad comment on my religious background. When I hear that phrase, I'm more likely to think of Monty Python
right,
than
I am too.
Than I am reference for the time being anyway, this is one of the best investments out there for very conservative people who are still seeking some income. And as a matter of fact, Andrea and her mother wanting to, what to do with the proceeds, this would probably be a good thing for her to look at. It has safety. It has very high yield. It is very liquid. It has extremely low costs, no expenses or sales charges. And there are some tax advantages. And they are Series I savings bonds.
I am all ears. I thought we talked about Series I saving bonds on the program a while back. Are they a lot better now?
They just got a lot better. The rate adjusts every 6 months. And so as of May 1st, it bumped up to, are you sitting down, people? If you're driving, you do want to pull over because I don't want you to get in an accident when you hear this. They are paying 4.6% annualized yield right now. That is good for the next 6 months. There is a 3-month penalty if you pull the money out between 1 and 5 years of maturity, but no penalty after that. And these are 30-year bonds, so you can technically keep them, let's see, for a very long time.
Oh, all right. So what are the advantages, tax advantages to these savings bonds?
Well, the interest, first of all, not only is 4.6% annualized, but it's exempt from state taxes. So for people in most tax brackets, that's going to be like getting almost 5% on a fully taxable investment like a CD. What's better about these is you can choose when to declare the interest and pay taxes on it. You can either do it annually or you can do it when you cash the bonds in or when they mature. So ideally, if a person is working right now and they're in a high tax bracket, but they plan on retiring and being in a lower tax bracket, they can buy the bonds today, defer declaring the interest and paying the taxes on it now, and then when they need the money in retirement, pull it out and hopefully pay it, pay a lower rate on those the interest at that time.
Well, you know, Kevin, my mom used to tell me, if it seems too good to be true, any drawbacks to these bonds?
Not many. The drawbacks are you can't buy enough of them. You can only buy $10,000 per person per year, and even that can only be done $5,000 online and $5,000 usually at a local credit union or bank. You can't buy them in retirement accounts like IRAs or Roth IRAs. And technically, the rate on these does fluctuate. So on November 1st, a new rate will come on your bond, and it could be as low as zero. There's actually a two-part component to the rate. There's a fixed rate, which right now is zero and forever on bonds issued right now, but then a floating rate according to a kind of a look back of what the consumer price index was. And so right now the inflation's high, so we're seeing 4.6%. It could go down, but even then you've only got a year to ride it out, and then you can pull it out and only pay 3 months penalty of interest.
So I'm sorry, I'm very slow. If I want to get some Series I savings bonds now because of this great interest rate, how long do I have to keep it invested?
You technically, there's a way to get it out right away, but you don't want to go through the hoops to do that. You shouldn't buy these unless you're planning on keeping the money in there at least a year. Between 1 and 5 years of holding the bond, if you pull it out early, you pay 3 months' interest in the penalty, but after 5 years, there's no penalty whatsoever to pull it out.
And so in November, even though I'm getting 4.6 now, November, that interest rate will change.
It will change. Yeah. It may go up. Yeah. The more we see $4 a gallon on gas, the more likely it is that it will be as high or higher.
Hey, I might be sold on this. So where can I get some more information?
Well, again, you can buy them at your friendly credit union or bank, but you can only buy $5,000 in person. So if you want to buy another $5,000 per person per year, you can go online at treasurydirect.gov, treasurydirect.gov, and we'll have a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Sounds good. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and our next caller is Nick in West Bend. Hello, Nick.
Hi there. Hi, Joy.
How are you, Nick?
Kevin. Good. Very good.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I had two questions today. My wife and I have been looking at purchasing a new home for some time and kind of debating whether we would buy now and probably take out a relatively small mortgage for a home, maybe $30,000 to $50,000. But conceivably, if we waited a year, we could buy a year later with possibly no mortgage. So that's one question I have. What would be the advantages to waiting versus now? And then we have two little ones, a two-year-old and a four-year-old. And I was wondering about EdVest. What are the benefits? And conceivably, what if you never use, you set aside money for EdVest, and what happens to it years down the road if you don't use it for a child's college education?
Okay, well, when you say...
That's a lot, I know.
No. When you say little ones, I just want to clarify, you mean children, correct?
Yeah, a two-year-old and a four-year-old, yeah.
Okay, good, because saving for college for a Cocker Spaniel, really...
I know, you have to have the...
Okay, well, first of all, the only people I think who should wait to buy a home are people in your situation who do plan on paying cash for it. I think prices will be lower, in some cases much lower, in the next year. People who are borrowing money to buy a home, which I would strongly recommend you consider for reasons that both the regular listeners are tired of hearing on this show, but I think you should at least consider getting a mortgage. It's a safer thing to do, and yes, paying interest stinks on it, but it's safer to have the money and the mortgage than it is to have no money and no mortgage. If you're set on paying cash for it, go ahead and do that, but otherwise, I'd rather have you buy now, borrow when interest rates are extremely low, and more importantly, it's easier to get a loan now than I think it will be for many people a year from now. I think interest rates may be higher. I think the government support for mortgages will be lower or non-existent, which means you'll have to come up with a bigger down payment. You probably have to pay a higher interest rate. It will probably be an adjustable rate mortgage, and it will probably be a 5 or a 15-year rather than a 30-year fixed. But again, if any of those things come true and you still are a cash buyer, Nick, you're going to get even lower prices because that will hurt the housing market even more.
So there's a benefit there, too. You could get lower prices in a year, possibly.
Absolutely. I will be blown away and pleasantly surprised if housing prices on a broad basis have gone up 12 months from now, but I don't think it's going to happen. Now, to the EdVest for the little ones. First of all, I think most middle-income people should save money in Roth IRAs for themselves first rather than using EdVest. The reason being is, do you qualify for a Roth IRA?
Yeah, we're presently doing the maximum per year on Roth IRAs in addition to Roth TSAs, yeah.
Okay, good, because you can pull the contributions out from a Roth IRA at any time. So since you can borrow money to go to college, but you can't borrow money to retire, a Roth IRA is the primary vehicle most people should use. Now, the EdVest accounts are neat because you remain the owners of the accounts with your children as the beneficiary, and all future earnings in the accounts are sheltered from taxes, and then if you pull them out and use them for qualified higher education expenses, there's no taxes whatsoever. Most times, Nick, there's no window or closing door on when that money can be used, because the people who write the tax code understand that many of us have gone back to school in our 30s or 40s or 70s, and that's probably likely to become more prevalent going forward. So there's really no sunset on when that money can be used. And even if you do pull it out, let's say you put $10,000 into an EdVest today, it grows to $15,000 by the time your kids are 18 and you need the money for something else other than college. If you pull it out, you'll only pay taxes and penalties on the profits, the $5,000 gain, which you would have paid taxes on anyway. And the penalty is relatively small. It's about 10% of the amount. So I wouldn't be fearful of, hey, they're probably not going to use this as a reason not to do an EdVest.
Okay. Oh, okay. Well, that's helpful. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Nick, for the call.
Yep, bye-bye.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Ashley in Hartford is with us now. Hi, Ashley.
Hi, Joy. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thanks for calling. Can Kevin help you out with something?
I hope so. My husband and I are paying about 49% of our income right now towards student loans, and we're not struggling, although with a family of four, we're kind of getting the itch to buy a house. We know we're not quite ready yet, but I guess we haven't consolidated any of our loans yet. We both went to private schools, so they did cost a lot, and I guess I was curious, would consolidating really be beneficial, or is it just paying more money over a longer period of time?
So have you looked into the terms under which you could consolidate those loans, Ashley?
No, we haven't. We've been doling out about 20 checks a month to different places. Mm. And our interest rates range from 2% is our best one, and then 8.5% interest rates all across in between there.
Okay. Well, I would, depending on the balance between the low-interest loans and the higher-interest loans, I would strongly suggest you consolidate, if for nothing else other than simplicity, that you get one check going out rather than 20. But I would also say that it might be beneficial, especially with a family, to extend the loan period out, because it lowers your fixed cash outflow every single month, which frees up cash for other emergencies and other things, like if you decide to buy a home. So, yeah, I'd like you to consolidate now while you can and while interest rates are relatively low. Look at the interest cost, though. If it might end up just being better if all those loans are fixed rate to just keep paying them off as you are. But I'm willing to bet that, again, depending on the mix, that you're probably going to save some money in interest, buy yourself some freedom. And if by extending the payment out, there's generally little or no prepayment penalty. But if something else comes up that's more urgent than paying these off, you'll have the money to do that.
Okay, and then I guess if student loans are our only debt, we've actually managed to pay off both of our vehicles. We don't have any credit card debt. If we consolidate them and we have some savings, does that put us in a good position right now to buy a house?
You mean to buy a house or get a mortgage?
Well, to get a mortgage.
Okay. Yeah. The interesting thing is that banks and lenders would actually rather have you have no student loans out and have you have car loans out, because they can always go get your car and take it if you don't make the payment on it. It's very difficult to say, excuse me, could we have your diploma in Egyptian art history or something? That doesn't provide, I'm sure it's valuable to majors in Egyptian art history, but it's not much value to the lender. So, that's good. Have you checked your credit scores recently?
Not recently, no.
Okay. Go to myfico.com and pay the $15 or whatever and see what they say. And the reason I say to do that now, even though you're not quite ready to buy a home, is because if there are errors on there that are dragging your scores down, you will take several months to fix those. And I'd rather have you working on that now rather than doing it while you're trying to close on a home.
Okay, that sounds great. Thanks a lot.
Ashley, thanks very much for the call. We'll get to more of your calls for Kevin in just a moment. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money.
You are listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with Kevin McKinley, who is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. And if you are devoted to using your debit card, there are a few things you should know about before you swipe. And Kevin, what are those things?
Well, it's an especially important issue to discuss if you're traveling this summer and planning on using your debit card. According to Visa and MasterCard, they have almost 2 debit cards issued per American citizen right now. So they're ubiquitous. They've replaced checks, they've replaced cash, and they've replaced credit cards. Extremely convenient. Some people in dire circumstances, it's always fun to watch them kind of at the supermarket, the head of them, they're kind of like, approved. Great. Okay, good. I can take my groceries and go home. I was like, good for you. I'm glad that. And debit cards are better than credit cards, because if you're worried you're going to borrow money that you can't afford to repay, better just to use the debit card. However, due to some recent developments, it's better in many cases to use cash or a credit card instead.
Well, what are the risks of using debit cards for these purchases?
Well, and especially if you're traveling and you're unfamiliar with the landscape, you have less recourse if something goes wrong and you want to dispute it than if you were to use a credit card, like reservations for a rental car or a hotel or some kind of tickets for it. You get there, it's not as expected. It's very difficult to dispute it with a debit card issuer compared to trying to dispute it with a credit card issuer. It's easier to delay payment and get the merchant having some skin in the game and resolving the problem here. Plus, you may need the cash in the debit card for future emergencies. So if you use credit first, and then once the emergencies and the traveling are all done, then you transfer money from your checking or savings account just to pay the credit card off. It's a little safer to do it that way.
Is there anything wrong with using the debit card for small purchases or for cash advances?
Well, nothing. As long as you know with whom you are dealing, there's been a huge rise in swipe scams and skimmers. These could be ATMs that are a little dodgy, and there could be a thief has put a skimmer on the door to enter the booth, if you will. So when you swipe your card to get in, they get your data for it. They can also put skimmers into the ATM machines that swipe your data. You still get your money out, but they get the data off it as well. And they're diabolical, because what they've done is rather than try to log your keystrokes, that's too difficult to get your PIN number. So they put a miniature pinhole camera up in the ATM booth so they can see which keys you're punching in on your ATM.
If only they'd use that, you know, that genius for good, huh?
Yes, right. Well, it's good for them, bad for us, right. But good for them. Many stores have even, and chain stores who should know better, have had devices attached to the machines at checkout. There have been several reputable stores that have their customers have had their information on their debit card stolen. And it's been through, you know, a dozen different stores throughout the chain or more, where you swipe it in there, you pay for it, everything's okay, but somehow they grab your data from it when you actually made the purchase.
So do you think I'm in trouble that I use my debit card accidentally instead of my security card to get into this building early in the morning?
No, you just launched the next pledge drive. Good for you.
Yeah, that's somebody made the joke about that too, that I had to pay to get in. But so if somebody does get my debit card data, what should I do?
Well, in theory, your liability is as much as money as you have in the account. If you notice it and report it within 2 days, it's usually going to be no liability and maybe $50 at the most. If you notice and report it within 60 days, usually at the most liability you're going to have is $500. But after that, it's, again, limited. If you have $10,000 in your debit card account and someone stole the information and you're not paying attention and 6 months go by, good luck trying to get that money back if it's been drained out of the account.
So how should we protect ourselves?
I would like people, first of all, to use the debit card just as, you know, keep a small balance in there. So it's only amount that you can lose is what you would put in there, and then transfer money over as needed. Definitely check your statements, not just reading the monthly statement, but checking online every week or so. And then don't use unfamiliar devices or locations to get cash. Go into a bank or a credit union and go inside, because it's less likely that those skimmers have been tampered with. And get and save receipts when you do use your debit card, so that if there is a dispute and it looks like more money was taken out when you made a transaction, that you have your receipt that says, no, this is all that I actually took out of it. And that'll give you some protection as well.
You know, Kevin, I hardly ever use my debit card, and now you're going to maybe yell at me. I use my credit card a lot more, but I don't have an issue paying off my credit card bill every month. I get airline miles and all that stuff if I use my credit card.
Yep, it's safer to do that, actually, if you trust yourself to pay the thing off. People should probably go away from debit cards, and if you're going to be spending just, you know, $20 or $40, take $20 or $40 with you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the most you can lose if you lose your wallet. And especially if you're going to be buying something online, do not use debit cards if you can help it, because you never know where that information is going to go. And again, you have less recourse if something goes wrong with your purchase.
Good to know. We have time for a few more calls for Kevin during this edition of On Your Money. And Chris in Winneconne is with us. Good morning, Chris.
Hi. I have three different 401ks from three different companies I've worked for in the past, and I'm looking to roll them over. And I talked with a financial investor, and they will roll over to an annuity, but they charge a upfront charge of like 4.5%. So I don't know if this is, you know, something I should do or if I should do it myself. He says, you know, you have a constant, you know, managers looking at your money then and taking care of it for you. But I don't know if it's worth it to save the 4.5% and just do a rollover on my own.
Well, Chris, thanks for the question. I think a bigger question I have here is, why do you have such a hard time staying at one place at work here?
Well, this is over several years. This is over about a 25-year period of time. And, you know, I never did anything with these, you know, with this money, and it's spread out all over the place.
Sure. Okay. Well, actually, then your employment tenure beats the average. Most people... especially people who've worked a long time, their average tenure on the job gets maybe close to 3 or 4 years per job. So you're beating the averages. So good for you. You're a good and loyal employee. Now, the question is what to do with this money. Yes, I'm okay. I'm any advisor who tells you what you're paying, that's a good sign, because you at least know what you're paying and to get for that. The question is whatever that fee is it worth it to you for whatever service they are going to provide? And if you say, no, I think this guy's above board and will be there even after he gets paid, I'm definitely okay, especially doing the paperwork from three different employers. There's going to be a lot of paperwork involved with this, because you have to go back and probably get the employers to sign off on you pulling the money out of each one and then making sure they all come over appropriately. So, you want to eliminate expenses wherever possible, but depending on your interest and abilities, this might be one worth paying. However, you don't have to do it if you don't want to. If you're comfortable keeping the eye on yourself, places like Vanguard or Schwab or Fidelity or a lot of other mutual fund companies will do this for you, and maybe not as well as this guy might, but it might be a lot less expensive too. So it's really a question of if you want to place your bets with this person. If it's someone with whom you have confidence, I would do it. But if you want to save the money and do it yourself, that's definitely possible as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris. Good luck to you. Rick in Appleton is with us now. Hi, Rick.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have some land that I'm thinking of selling. I'm thinking of selling it because I believe capital gains taxes will go up after 2012. If I sell it, my question is, do I have to pay those capital gains taxes within a certain period of time after the sale, or can they be paid when I file my income tax returns for 2011?
Just thinking about that.
Yeah, right? I'm thinking about there might be another way to skin this proverbial cat here. No offense out to PETA members out there. I'm not really skinning cats here right now. Can you give me a rough idea of what the gain might be, Rick?
Oh, the gain would be about $190,000.
Okay. And have you talked with a CPA yet, or anybody on planning some tax strategies for this?
I haven't. I'm not thinking of rolling it over by buying a 1030, using 1031 strategy to roll the funds over.
Okay.
I'm thinking I want to pay the capital gains because I believe the taxes are going to be higher later.
Yeah, I think you're right. And even if they're not, I think that the prices may be lower at the same time. So I think you'll get more money by selling now rather than later, especially if you're going to sell it sooner or later anyway. If it's something you wanted to keep for 30 years, that's a different story. Where you're going to maybe run into a problem is not so much that, you can definitely wait to pay it, but the problem is then it will trigger an estimated tax where you have to start filing for the future to prove that the government wants their money that they have coming to them as soon as possible. And so it's not so much that you have to pay it sooner than April 15th. It's that then after April 15th, you may be on a schedule where you have to start doing estimated taxes because you had a huge liability that you didn't pay for on an ongoing basis. And we've talked about this before, and I'll try to find a link and we'll put it up at onyourmoney.com of the best way to handle that.
Okay, right. And I was advised by a realtor to work with a CPA. I've always done my own taxes. I've never dealt with a CPA. I've done everything myself. But do you think this is something I really should go to a CPA and work?
Absolutely.
With a CPA?
Without a question. We'll put a link up to the Wisconsin CPA site so you can look for someone in your area.
I'm amazed people think they want to do this themselves.
Oh, my gosh.
Anyway, we have time for the website of the week, Kevin.
Well, we've had several questions before, Joy, about people saying, well, I want to get my kids interested in money. So is there a stock market simulation game online? And I probably wouldn't be here if it weren't for a stock market simulation example that we did when I was 14 years old. However, I don't like those because they are much closer to casino gambling than they are to actual real-world finances. So we found a site that presents really tough decisions for people, like a simulation of what life is like, saying if you take a part-time job, how much are you going to get paid after rent? What are your health insurance expenses going to be? What are you going to have left over? It's playspent.org. Playspent.org. And we'll have a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
You know what, Kevin? It's college commencement time, and I'm wondering if you might have four words of advice for college graduates.
Spend less, Have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner. He is managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and we will talk to him again next week, next Tuesday, between 8 and 9, for another edition of On Your Money. Tomorrow at this time, philosophy isn't just a bunch of stuffy contemplation. It can offer us guidance at every stage of our lives. We will be talking with the author of Driving with Plato tomorrow morning between 8 and 9. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Chris Molina for producing this hour. Thank you for listening and for calling in. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.